G'day and welcome to this episode of Conquering Leadership. Today we're here with Conrad Singh, which is why I said g'day, because he's of Australia, but born in South Africa, grew up in Australia, started playing tennis at a very young age. He played juniors, college, and played pro tennis over in Europe. But today he's in the business of tennis as a COO of Centre Courts Tennis over in New Jersey in the US. But equally, Conrad's got a fascinating pathway and a fascinating journey. And he's, but some of the highlights here, he was owner of the China Elite Tennis Academy, where he coached national and provincial tennis players, rising stars like Li Na coming out of China in recent years. He set up the Vita Tennis organization in Australia before he went to China. And prior to that, he was the author of Biomechanics of Tennis, which became the go-to manual for tennis coaches in Australia. So, like Conrad, you're a pretty young dude and you've done all these things. You've hit the sky and you're still flying. How's that for an intro?
Thanks a lot, Angus. You kind of summarized me in a few words, but it's been a long journey, and it's a great journey. I'm very fortunate. I don't really feel like I've ever not enjoyed what I'm doing, whether it be coaching, whether it be, you know, business, whether it be education. They're all sort of one sort of groove, if that makes sense, yep, in the tennis industry.
So this show's about leadership, and in essence, you've been leading since the early days as a player, a lead player, if you like, as an author, leading on the biomechanics front, as a coach. You've done the hard yards of coaching through to your own coaching business, and now you're on the business management side over there on the East Coast. Give us a few specifics, a few highlights of that career and some of your standout points for our audience who are, they're mixed, they're US-based and international.
Yeah, look, Angus, I really think that the sport of tennis itself by very nature is, it's a very difficult sport and you spend a lot of time on your own and from a very young age, even my kids right now, they're 6 and 8 years old and they're already developing independency. And so when you talk about leadership, being independent and having no fear of being challenged and walking paths that are unwalked are very important. And you've got to be brave, you've got to be bold, and, you've got to make calculated decisions. And that's what tennis is. And so I feel like playing that sport, whether it be in the city of Melbourne when it's, 42, 44 degree heat and you're out there struggling for 2-3 hours and you're learning to deal with that. And through that, you develop stamina and you develop efficiency and you develop all these different tools that actually do help you in life. And I feel like some of the key skills from the sport of tennis that have helped me to, I guess, pioneer in some areas and not be afraid of having a go are different areas that, resilience, I think, is a major part. As I just mentioned, the sport itself helps you develop that. Anyone who knows the culture of Australia, sports culture of Australia, and, especially a city like Melbourne, where I'm from, which is just mad sports city, we really do encourage anyone that's very keen on a sport and anyone who is showing any sort of, ability, we kind of really support that. It's very important. But I think overall, you got to look at, it, of course, I'm from tennis, but sport as a whole is education through life, right? And the things I believe that it educates you in, I could just bang them off. You learn to be motivated. You learn to be goal orientated. You understand commitment. You understand how important it is to concentrate at different times. Of course, you've got to have those relaxation times, fun times, but that switch on button and mode, it becomes more natural when you've come from sport. I'm dealing with pressure. I mean, tennis, just watch a tennis match. It's so dramatic. You're dealing with pressure and that's very similar to running a business or trying to start a new enterprise. You got to be determined, right? You got to show determination. There's a lot of learning that goes on by failing. You got to be tennis harnesses all of these things. You learn to cope, right? You learn to develop these coping mechanisms to deal with various problems that come your way in a tennis match, no different to in a business or in coaching other people. You learn to be efficient, show a bit of tenacity. You got to harness your emotions. I mean, I could keep going. The sport of tennis is just so challenging in every way that it really does help you with developing those foundational tools.
You said something there which to me is quite interesting, and it's a bit of a mantra I've used in the world of business leadership coaching, and about lonely. You mentioned tennis is lonely, and I say leadership is lonely. And there's an interesting spin-off from that, because you mentioned things about decision-making processes, calculated decisions, intentional learning, coping mechanisms. These are all things that modern executives need to get abreast of, and some do better than others. But do you think that's why a lot of executives play tennis? Because tennis is like their lives?
That's a fair point. I've actually never thought of that, Angus. And to be honest, you know, the sport is, it's fast, it's intense. You get your moments of break, it's dramatic. And I feel like, it does draw in a certain type of character, a certain type of personality. The other thing with a sport like tennis is the amount of risk that you take is entirely up to you. I mean, you can play it safe, you can camp back behind the baseline and extend your rallies, or you can play a quick pressure point, get up to the net, risk it all, roll the dice, you know, and no different to, like I said to you, being in a business or being a leader. And I think that, you know, probably one of the hardest parts of the sport of tennis is that you don't have someone to rely on while you're out there, right? You're not allowed to be coached while you're playing. And that really does teach you to become self-reliant. It teaches you to make decisions and back them. And then what Rafa Nadal and these top players do so well, they will never throw blame. If they lose, then it's them. They will wear it on their sleeve. It hurts them like hell, but they'll wear it and they'll get better for it. So I do feel like a lot of those early attributes that are learnt through playing a sport like this are transferable in later life into all aspects of life. Yeah.
Yeah, some very interesting parallels there. Quick left turn here, because I was fascinated by biomechanics as a young age. My schooling is way back in when the world was black and white. So biomechanics was just an idea in the mind of somebody's god. Once I got into a competitive sport and the gym industry came to the UK, I couldn't afford to go to a gym, so I had to self-learn. So I'd like to hook into that a little bit. What inspired you to write that book? And how young were you in your career at that point?
Yeah, good question. Look, obviously, when I was sort of graduating out of high school and going into college, sports science was just sort of starting to hum a little bit, you know, back in the early 90s. And a lot of myself and friends, we were, you know, playing elite level sports. So we were exposed to some of, I guess, the new training methods that were coming in, whether it be wearing heart rate monitors or having video cameras on us while we were playing, or measuring the amount of sort of running that was being done during a match type thing. And so I found all that really interesting sort of as an athlete. And my passion towards, and I guess my eye was always very keen on technique. I come from a sports family. My father was an elite cricket player. My mum was an elite hockey player. And we're always watching sport, and I was fascinated, again, listening to commentators, and I'd always want to hear the niggly details of, you know, how is it that this player develops more of that and the other. And so it was always sort of something that kind of tickled my fancy, if you like, growing up as an athlete. So then when it came time to sort of, you know, decide what am I going to study, it was inevitable I was going into sport. I'd kind of already made a decision, you know, let's say at 17, 18, you know, all my friends, my sort of peer group level growing up were extremely good. And sort of going back, looking at what did everyone achieve, you know, 6, 7, 8 guys all made it to the top 100, 200 in the world. So Melbourne, we were developing top athletes. I was always stuck between playing a team sport as well, like Aussie rules football, which I really enjoyed you know, the mateship and the kind of the team stuff that comes along with it. So I was always a little bit torn, and then sort of out of school going into just tennis and focusing on tennis, I really wanted to specialize. And I remember having a conversation very early on, I think I would have been 17 years old, with a guy who was a tennis-specific physiotherapist. And he had told me, you know, look, there's so many good coaches out there. It's very hard to make it in sport, specifically in a country like Australia. You're going to need to specialize in something. So what is it that you really like other than the sport? And so I sort of said, look, I'm really keen on the technical side. I feel I understand it well, but I want to know it more. I was very fortunate. The university that I went to in Melbourne, Deakin University, was the leading sports science programs in the world at that time. I haven't followed since. I'm not too sure where they are now, but definitely at that time. And we had a lot of really elite coaches that were coaching the AFL, a lot of footballers, pro footballers, sportsmen walking around. So we were always the ones that were at the cutting edge of technology. And so, yeah, I found myself at the end of sort of analyzing natural human gait, sort of the walking mechanisms and how do people walk and stride lengths and whatnot, which then transferred to a practicum placement where I was working with the Australian Institute of Sport and the Victorian Institute of Sport, which was all in Melbourne. Again, lucky to be in Melbourne. And then obviously we had the Australian Open every year. So I was a part of little projects around that, all geared towards biomechanics that kind of fueled my interest. So it was obvious to go through and study that area, do my honours and masters in that area, and then come out and, you know, have the opportunity again through the networks that I'd built as a player. These guys that I'm, you know, they're now in the back end of the sport. So I was asked by Tennis Coaches Australia at that time if I could put together the advanced coaches module in Victoria for coaches. It was a 6-month long coaching course. So, you know, I value education unbelievably. So for me, that was so interesting to be a part of that. Went very well. And then through that, I had the opportunity to author the book for Advanced Biomechanics of Tennis. And post that, I guess a lot of the best in the world, from Bruce Elliott to Mark Reed, some of these absolute gurus in biomechanics, they've gone further and further. And now it's just so intrinsic in the sport. But yeah, I'm very happy to be a pioneer in that area back in the 90s.
That's really cool. Yeah, I love hearing that. And you're pretty much an industry disruptor from a young age, which is going to help you in this COVID world, because all our industries are having to pivot. Where do you think, just leaping into the now, where do you think tennis is good at pivoting, and how do you think it's going to adapt in the COVID era?
That's a great question, Angus. Look, we kind of made, when I say we, I made a decision early on, I'm going to call it in March when all this was happening, that we wanted to stay cutting edge. And so I stepped up as the CEO at tennis for Centre Court. And part of my role in doing so was to make sure that we're at the pioneer's end. You know, my own mission was I wanted to be the first academy in the USA to have an online tennis academy, if you like. And we did that through a partnership with some friends over in Europe. I wanted to make sure that our coaches stayed at the very front end of what was going on all around the world, whatever was coming out, whatever was being found out. And so we did a lot of webinars to raise the bar on education standards for our team. You know, I'm just so passionate about that education side. And I've tried to have that filter through the rest of the team that I look after. Even so that we've set up a whole internal coach education platform just for Centre Court Tennis Academy. So we've set it up in a way that we can run mini courses, which I run with my team. And, you know, our coaches, rather than sort of sitting on their iPads, wasting time on social media, they're bettering themselves, right? They're using the same platforms to go through stuff that interests them. So during this new COVID era, I hope, I pray, and I feel that tennis has moved forwards in leaps and bounds. Like, one of our industry standards that I'd like us to have is to be super professional and super diligent in, you know, the hiring process. So different things like rates of pay, all of those things needed to move forwards. And I feel like COVID has helped actually the tennis industry. in that we've all sort of come together. I was recently part of a summit, a global summit, which was called the Between the White Lines Summit, run by a great fellow from your background, Mark Jeffrey. He basically pulled together entrepreneurs from around the world that were referred by other entrepreneurs, tennispreneurs, we're calling them, to get together. And we ran a summit for 3-4 days. Guys who are that good at what they do, they're not involved in national associations. National associations could never afford to pay these guys. So we got all them together, and everyone's been delivering on different topics that are outside of the, you know, the normal grain. One of my topics of expertise has been culture and relationships. Yep. And you well know from your time in China, without knowledge of that, you cannot succeed. So we're trying to raise the level of education across the board, whether it be technology, whether it be specifics like mechanics, whether it be how to use technology as a coach these days, or whether it be touching topics that are not taught in regular coaching seminars, such as culture and relationship building. So I feel like COVID has really actually given us the time, which is the one, you know, asset that we all want more of. It gave it to us. So we were able to go out and do what we needed to.
Yeah, it's fascinating, and it's exciting to hear. I've got a big smile on my face because I'm passionate about the Education Development of Talent Act. And that's basically why I got into rugby. It wasn't to be a professional team coach. It's to be in the next level down, the evolution and development of the players. And I'm going to doff my hat to you, because prior to meeting you way back when, I had very little understanding of tennis. And now, yeah, outside of a rugby match, if I'm going to watch something on the TV, it'll be a tennis match, because you tapped intrinsically into some things that are in my genetic makeup as I've got more mature, if you like. Given half a chance, I'll go out and go across to the tennis courts and just hit at the machine. And I have a ton of fun with it. I didn't realize it was that much fun. And then in the business development side, you introduced me, I don't know if you remember, when we're trying to get, you know, sports, making sports popular, and time on ball, which is a concept I've heard in rugby and tennis, in soccer. And you'd introduced me to, they'd reduce the speeds of the balls. If you remember, the green, yellow and red balls, which made it easier for players to get time on ball in a rally, slightly different tennis racket sizes. Small stuff like that is just absolutely fantastic in the business development world.
Oh, completely. And I mean, if you look at, I guess we're very fortunate to spend, you know, golden years in China together, where we, you know, we both were around when exciting stuff was happening in sport in that country. And, you know, hat off to you for what you did. I mean, I'll never forget what you built in a very short period of time. You know, 3,000, 4,000 kids per week playing sport was just phenomenal. And that was all you and your passion. But during that time, I do recall us working together with some of your young enthusiasts, let's call them sort of PE graduate type of guys. And we're trying to turn them into complete sports professionals. And we put together a coaching course. And I'll tell you what, I'll never forget, we had probably 10 or 12 young guys and girls who never played tennis that were really into it. And by the end of it, we'd see them out there hitting balls. And that's what the sport does. But bringing it back to your point, tennis got to a real crisis point, Angus. I don't know if you know this, but in a country like Australia, we dropped from the second-ranked sport to outside the top 10. We dropped to number 11 or so. And the reason being that the sport is so damn difficult. It takes a lot of reps for mastery. In order to get those reps, you need access to clubs, coaches, equipment. That's all expensive, courts. So the easiest way to get people to love it, get the hook in the mouth, is to get them good at it. And so to do that, tennis really kind of pioneered that red, orange, green, yellow system. And if you look at today, right now where I am at Center Court Tennis Academy here in New Jersey, we have the largest 10 and under program in the USA. And so we have 515 kids in one center per week playing in the red ball, 300 kids in an orange ball, 200 kids in a green ball, and then well over 1,000 plus kids playing playing yellow ball, right? So
holy cow, that's phenomenal, man.
Well, that's in one center. That's in one center, and we have nine centers, right? So if you look at that system, the catchment, the ability to catch more kids at that young age, call it 4, 5, and 6, it keeps them in the sport. And the players that we've now seen go through the line and come out yellow ball, you know, we developed the number 2 player in the world, 4-10 and under, a couple of years ago through that program, right? So it works. And time on ball, or golden time, or rally time, or live ball time, whatever you want to call it, that's when the enjoyment is on, right? The instincts are alive. Players are reading the ball, reacting to the ball, preparing. There's all these decisions going on. And if you can hook kids into that early, they really see that tennis is more than knocking a ball over a net. And that's what we're trying to really get kids around, the decision-making, the building of something. So we say, you know, first to start, then build, then look for a chance, then finish. So you're teaching kids all these different modes of play that you get in all these other sports, whether it be attack, defense, you know, neutral, in dispute. All those things, they're the words we use when we're coaching young kids today.
Yeah.
Because we're trying to get it away from just the knocking of the ball or feeding of a ball with some guy hitting. We're getting kids into rallying from pretty much the first, second, third time they're on a court. And that's really helped with that equipment.
that's phenomenal. And I love the sport so much. I could make this whole show just let's talk about your sport. But let's curve it back round a little bit to the central theme of leadership. And and you give me a ton of material here to work with, which bless you for that. But for you, Conrad Sieg, what defines leadership?
Such a broad topic. If I was going to simplify it the easiest way I could, I'm going to say that it's experience plus opportunities. So if you have had enough experiences, and they've got to be broad and varied, they've got to be, as I mentioned earlier, front end, back end, around the administrative side, around other former, you know, great coaches, great players. That for me equals experience. You know, and this is where true leaders create more leaders. And I understand that better than I think most in my industry. I'm one of those guys who I'm not overly protective of my seniority, if you like. I will be the guy that goes out. If I'm hiring someone for what I think, what I see, and what I feel they're going to be capable of. I'm not going to hire someone that's come out of the top position and expect them to come into my position and repeat that. I don't want that. I'm looking for someone that's showing me they have all of the characteristics to take an opportunity and run with it as far as they can.
Yep.
Now, what I believe true leaders will do is firstly lead by example. So give a lot of examples in terms of, all right, you know, back when so-and-so this happened, this was the experience that I had, and these were what I learned from it. You know, give a little bit of guidance. And so I'm big on experiences. I'm really big on opportunities. I've got to stress that. If there's an opportunity that comes along, even if you don't feel you're up to it, grab it, take it, and learn on the fly. And, you know, I think a lot of what I've done is, and a lot of what probably helped me was my years from, I'm going to call it 19 through 24, 25, 26 years old, I tried to be around the best in the industry. And I was lucky that I was. I was around real leaders in the sport of tennis. You know, most people have never heard of, but they were just so good at what they were doing. And I was able to learn from them what was good and what was not good. I was also able to customize what's my style. And I think leadership is very unique. Everyone's got stylistic differences. Follow what's natural. You know, my coaching philosophy forever has never changed. It's teach what's essential, encourage what's natural, and allow for every individual. That's basically my mantra. And, you know, it hasn't changed in 20 odd years. And I try to get my young staff, my team, my future leaders to also have a philosophy that they stick to. You know, analyze yourself regularly. Are you fulfilling by your actions what it is that you are delivering as a methodology to leadership? So, yeah, I hope that answers a little bit what the question was.
Yeah, there's some really good points in there. vive la différence, as the French say, you know, in terms of stylistic difference. And I think that's quite one thing I've noticed over the years is how, as you say, people get in leadership roles and they have a stylistic difference, yet some of the environments that are business environments that are built don't actually enable people to be the person that got them there in the first place. So what I'd like to ask you there, and particularly, and we've earlier on in this discussion, we spoke about tennis naturally evolves leadership traits. So by the time people are in a competitive arena, they're leading their own lives in a very functional fashion. So as a leader of leaders, what clues or tips can you give us to help those in a similar role, whether it's senior management or an executive role? You are leading high functioning, highly functional, ambitious people.
Well, look, I think the first thing is due diligence, right? You got to know, you know, history leaves clues. You got to go back and you got to look and you got to see and you got to, you know, look at the communities. What communities has that person been around? Has he been around area or she been in areas within the industry or within, you know, the role that you're looking at that are going to empower them to higher things? Are they motivated? Are they coming from, you know, a highly motivated family background? If you're privy to get this stuff, the due diligence will really help you to select the right people for leadership roles. Yep. But I think the key thing, you know, and I'm not trying to, you know, reinvent the wheel. I'm just really stating what I believe. You've got to have led by example. It's very hard to preach a message if you've not walked the path in some capacity. Yep. So, you know, people, future leaders want to hear stories. They want guidance. They want to know, what would you do in that situation? So being approachable, being able to, you know, make time for your team is so important. And I do that. I make my team know that, you know, listen, guys, these couple of days, I'm really, really boxed in. I can't get free to spend that time together. But these couple of days, let me know when you're free. Let's go grab a coffee. Let's get to know each other a little. Let's talk. You know, how can I help? What tools can I give you?
Yeah.
You know, you've got to invest to get the best. Is I say that every time. You've got to invest to get the best. And so, you know, how can I help you? What do you need? Do you need to do a course? I've gone as far as, you know, paying for out of my own pocket, paying for my future leaders to go and study a course that I believe in, whether it be, you know, you need to go and do a course in, you know, mechanics, advanced biomechanics, or you need a course in administration of blah, 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 blah. I've funded many of my team members to go and do those things because I really believe that education is a lifelong pursuit and education is the backbone of leadership. Cultural awareness is something that I want to talk about just briefly.
Yeah.
You know, you we're in such a diverse world, Angus. Look at us. We're both foreigners living in here in the US and, you know, in any one day, I might pass by 15 different nationalities. I've got to have some type of awareness. I've got to be, you know, you got to make that time to understand what are the drivers of a certain culture without being obviously too generic. You've really got to make that time. And I do the same thing for my team. I'd like to know, you know, their family, their kids. What's driving them? Why do you want to do this? And you know, sport is not easy. Tennis is absolutely not easy. It's expensive. It's extremely difficult sport to get good at. You know, you're dealing with parents. We deal with parents more than any other sport. And so I want to know that my leaders, they have patience. They have the ability to be tolerant of people's differences. They have the capacity to sit down and listen and not necessarily have to overpower that conversation. They're all sort of skills you won't know your team has unless you spend time with them.
That's a phenomenal insight, and you know, particularly on the back end of the election here. And I think a lot of people, you embrace the US for what it is, which is a multicultural, multi-faith society, which seems to generate its own set of anxiety issues for some people. But when you come back to sport, the whole point about sport is it's supposed to be inclusive and representative. And you look at you know, I remember having this conversation with my parents way back when, who are of the boomer generation, because they couldn't comprehend how a person of non-white skin color could have a British passport. And fast forward to now, and you know, anyone can turn up in your team. And I look at culture, I always look at people, and as coaches, we're in the industry of people, we're in the industry of talent acquisition and talent development. So human nature, there's a lot of common themes in human nature, and culture is just sort of the packaging that that particular person comes in. If you can embrace the packaging, you'll find the human
you're
underneath.
Spot on. I mean, look, I'm a South African born, Australian raised, married to a Mexican Latino, lovely woman, Paula. Have my kids who spent all their young years in China speaking Chinese. My father is of Indian descent. My mother is of European descent. I mean, I'm a walking mongrel. So
you're a walking rainbow nation.
Right. So, you know, and I try to encourage that in my kids, in the people I coach. The way I coach as an actual on-court professional tennis coach, it's very different if I'm dealing with someone who's with a Chinese background where, you know, I know I'm dealing with the player, both their parents, and both of the parents, both parents. So, yeah. You know what I'm saying? So you got to factor.
Because it's an investment. Tennis at some levels, and I don't know if it's the same here in the US, but in China, it was an investment in their futures, wasn't it?
Oh, categorically. And it is here thanks to the college system as well. The drivers right. for kids to get into a sport and be good at it is ultimately they want to get to a good college using their sport, whether it be, you know, on some type of scholarship or just to get into a really good school that supplements their grades. But, you know, I wish every country had that sort of system for tennis, because it drives tennis in the US at every level, whether it be junior varsity, college, and then pro. Now that we know, you know, all of these tennis players, the average age of peak tennis player male now is 27 and a half years of age. And female is 26. You got to go to college. Versus in my day, it was you're going pro or you're going to school. It's one or the other. So today you got to do it all.
There's another topic you've just there. We do another show on the business of the business, couldn't we? So just coming back round to some of the pressures of leadership, and it's a hot button topic right now, mental health awareness. You and I both know the stresses of executive leadership as a coach or a business owner operator. What tips can you give for our listeners around mentally and emotionally, as well as physically in good shape, not fall down that well? And I've fallen down the well. I've been in the bottom of the well a few times, I must admit.
And I think we all have, Angus, you know, if we're honest. And what you project out is not always what's going on. And that's part of the challenge of being a leader, right? So not everyone can handle that. You know, loose lips sink ships, as it were. And you know, sometimes you do want to just blurt it out. You want to just, you know, get it out. And so the discipline of not doing that is often at the detriment of the individual, of the humanistic side of the individual. I've been extremely lucky, Angus, in that I have, you know, my wife, Paola, was our managing director in China of both of our businesses, the Ebersen Soccer Academy and the China Elite Tennis Academy. And you know, we went into this together and she was great for me. I was able to share the day-to-day stress with her. Probably not so great for her, but it was great for me. And so that's, I think, important. I think you need a partner in crime. You need someone, whether it be another person in your team or someone who's completely, you know, not in the business with you and can give you honest and truthful feedback. Someone you trust to give you honest and truthful feedback. That's important. But the biggest tip I can give is really the 5 P's. Prior preparation prevents poor performance. You just got to be prepared, whatever it is, whether it be, you know, going into something with all the possible outcomes already sort of laid out. I'm a big scribbler. I'm a big time notepad scribbler. And I'll go back often to my notes that I wrote months ago. And I was, oh my gosh, look at that. That we actually predicted that. Yep, there it is. Same deal. So that's just part of how I operate. And, you know, it's not cutting edge technologically probably the way to go, but it works for me.
Yeah, fantastic. And thanks for doing that. Because I always respect people who are willing to just lift the lid on it a little bit more and shine the light in there, because on my previous show, I was talking about with Evan, who's a US Marine Corps veteran, and he's a PTSD sufferer, and he was willing to go really deep on PTSD. And there's many people suffering with some kind of trauma or mental health issue, particularly post-COVID. There's very few leaders in my experience that are willing to just take time out and just check in and make sure, hey, mate, you okay? And part of that is checking in on yourself. And so good on you. And thanks for opening up on that. Who inspired you, Conrad?
It's a great question. I think my dad, to be honest, was someone who, I think I mentioned earlier, I was born in South Africa. My father was a professional cricket player. And really under apartheid and all of those sort of challenging times, trying to pioneer a young family, you know, a business, a professional sports career, it was very difficult. And I always looked up to my father and what he did. He was a complete workhorse. He still is a complete workhorse. 7 days a week, he enjoyed going to work. And I've tried to always implement that into myself. So personally, I'm going to say my father. Professionally, I've been very, very fortunate. Like I said, coming from Melbourne has been a major thing for me, whether it be I've had role models who are the best of the absolute elite of what they're doing in a range of sports. So whether it be tennis, whether it be soccer, whether it be Australian rules football, golf, I've had mates who I, you know, I've grown up with or who have gone on, or even guys who are older than me that had been there and done it, that really kind of, we're very close and speak openly and honestly about how we're doing. And so they've always helped me to keep very clear, good, grounded opinions on, you know, which is the right way to go. But I just feel it's so important, Angus, to have role models, to have people that you are always kind of able to bounce things off and get those, you know, perspectives. But we talked about it a second ago, and that is also staying true to yourself. Is something for me. I know what I like doing, whether it be outside of the sport. I know what my values in terms of, you know, what I want to spend my time doing. And that sort of stuff has always helped me. And you know, I've got a very small circle of friends. Let's say that, you know, we all got a lot of friends, but very tight friends. There's probably five of us that go back to teenagers. And so I'm constantly checking in with them. Yes, I live on the other side of the world in a completely different time zone. But all of that really helps, I think, to, you know, get back to the original vision as well.
No, it was an interesting point you say there about peer professionals and mentors. And one of the things I was always over my life, I come from a dysfunctional background. So at a young age, I kept finding, just naturally or intrinsically, finding older mentors in the world of business and to help me move forward. And then when I met you and also John Dyke, who was on this show a few episodes ago, and he's at Manchester United back then, Manchester City. But you and he were great, because when I was over in Shanghai, I had no peer professionals till you guys showed up. And have cross-industry peer professionals was a massive, massive burden lifter or burden reducer. You guys are phenomenal. Just to be able to have even a 5-minute conversation, or that like little nod across the table, I know what you're going through.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, I had a mate of mine in Shanghai who was really a role model for me early on when I started my business there, which was, you know, a lot of pressure. He was a former boxer who, you know, was a great boxer. He's a little tough guy who is actually Ebisan's brother. So I ended up in business with Ebisan, who was a great soccer player, you know, one of the best of all times from the Bundesliga. He played for Denmark. His brother was one of my mentors, who was an absolute entrepreneur. And he guided me a lot in my decision-making early on, you know, which way to go. And I was the same, just an hour with him. You know, he'd make time for me when I needed it, you know, more than any. We were members at the same sort of social club. So we'd catch up for a beer or a coffee or whatever for an hour. And it would normally end up being much longer than an hour. But it was great, because I'd come away with a lot of perspectives, a lot of ideas. But like I was saying earlier, these were real life experiences, right? So it wasn't someone telling me, you know, you should do this, you should do that. Speaking from a place of absolutely no idea, this guy had lived it. And so... Yeah, I agree with you. It was very motivating to have that. And I still look for it today. I still seek it. You know, it's part of, I guess, who I am as a person. Always looking for role models.
Well, I'm here for you, Conrad.
I found you again.
So I'm going to come back round to education, because, and I'm going to confess, because on one of your other shows, you said something in response to a question, and it really dinged a bell for me in a positive way, because it's one of the challenges in rugby, and what I've seen in the development of rugby coaches is sort of an anti-education mindset in a lot of people. And you pretty much nailed it. So the question is, what is the difference, or what are some of the key differences between coaching and training?
Oh, mate. Oh, you're speaking my absolute passion here. I really feel like coaching, you know, when you're talking about guiding a person's passion and you're talking about, you know, cultivating the interests of a human being, when you're coaching someone, you've got to think about the actual meaning of the word coach. It's originally goes back to a carriage going from place A to place B. So that's essentially what we're doing. We're using sport as a vehicle, in my case, tennis. But coaching is really pulling the best out of that individual and helping them to understand through conversation, through showing, video, whatever it might be, that we can get better. But this is what you do well. And the reason you do it well is X, Y, and Z. How can we continually bring that out in a way that's consistent, in a way that is going to be repeatable? And so coaching for me is doing that. And it's also, you know, trying to make it as real as possible. So how can we continue to make this situation, for example, in tennis, more realistic? We're going to bring in a lot of the variables that we have in competition. Versus training, for example, is taking what we have and trying to accelerate it a little further. So when we're coaching versus training, there is a very different approach. And so as a tennis person, tennis coach, I need to know the different environment that I'm walking into to be able to deliver exactly what it is that that player needs. I have players right now, pro player. I have one girl who's 250 in the world, WTA, which doesn't sound like much, but that's pretty damn good. She's taken Serena and she's taken Kvitova and those players all the way. So she can play.
Oh, wow.
And right now we're going back to coaching, whereas she's been training for years. And so what we've realized is that the training environment has not created learning opportunities for her, has not created new stimulus to be excited by the sport. And so by doing that, some of the comments I'm getting are, oh my God, I haven't felt like this since I was 14, you know, back in a coaching environment, one coach around me working on my technique, one coach around me working on my footwork, another coach timing my runs, you know. So it's very important you have the balance of both. Two completely different environments.
Yeah, man, that's I love what you're saying, and yeah, I can completely buy into it, because and thinking back to what you were saying earlier about not only empowering them, but enabling the person to develop their own personal style, training can become sterile. And I had a young fella just for 6 to 8 weeks, just for an exhibition game, and he was a top fella, you know, top athlete, very, very good. And he wanted to play a position, and we were going up against the New Zealand team. So in rugby, they're pretty hot. And I spent, in the 8 weeks I had with it, I spent 50% of the time trying to unpick bad habits so he could perform the way he wanted to perform in the game. Now, he loved it, but the investment of time in that was phenomenal. And I think what I'm coming to is a sum up on there. Coaching is a time and an emotion investment, but it yields great outcomes.
Yeah.
Training is a time and emotional investment, but it yields restricted outcomes, because it can be a bit Pavlovian. So it develops players into bad habits, because the player's a reflection of the individual that's trained them rather than the individual that's coached them.
The way you've articulated that is spot on, and I'm going to go back and watch that again and again. But I agree with you entirely. Part of my mission when training an athlete is to enable them to self-coach. And so what you have to be able to do is have them put the mirror on themselves and start to be critical of themselves in a constructive way, which for many people, particularly tennis players who have a protected ego and an ego they have to protect, is very challenging. And what I have found is those little spurts, those little moments of development that happen at various times within the timeline of a player's career. Players aren't always improving. There's a lot of time that they're just surviving. There's a lot of time that they're, you know, just trying to get over the line to get the next little bit of breathing space to start again. They want to hit the reset button over and over. And so, you know, when you've got a player in training mode, let's say pre-competition or 2 weeks out from, you know, two more weeks of competition, I'm really focusing a lot on them developing the self-coaching skill. Now, to have that, I've got to have an athlete that's prepared to be reflective, prepared to be honest with themselves. I mean, the minute an athlete's not honest with themselves and they're not honest with me, I look them in the eyes and say, you know, we're not going to get anywhere here. Do you want to – let's restart again tomorrow. But it's that self-coaching skill that really will help the athletes to become better. And many times in tennis, that's never taught. You get the coach – you know, just pumping balls at this player. And often one of my little catch moments about coaching itself, how much time are you giving the athlete between each ball?
Yeah.
Not many people think about that, right? But we talked earlier about live ball time. Remember the red, orange, green? Yeah. You're giving them more time in live ball to get better at the skill. But when you're talking about a player, they already have the skill. They need to have the mindset prior to executing the skill. And so what I see a lot is inexperienced coaches working with very good players, and it's just literally the most expensive ball machine you've ever seen. They're just pumping balls out of there. But what the player needs is reflection time, right? So hope that helps a little bit. I mean, it's really the self-coaching comes, I think, through constant reminder from that coach.
Well, and I think actually on a professional level, you've nailed something there. That to be a good coach, you've got to walk the walk on those coaching skills if you want the players to do it, and then you can hold up the mirror. But human nature likes the path of least resistance and ends up in being the most expensive ball feeding machine because that's the and sometimes inexperience breeds insecurity, and then insecurity traps the player, and because the coach doesn't want the player to evolve because they don't have an education mindset, which you addressed earlier.
You know, Angus, I've got a girl right now that I've started working with a couple months ago. You will not believe what I'm looking at. I mean, anyone who knows tennis will be blown off their chair. This girl has arguably got the worst technique I've ever seen for a top 100 athlete. She's a top 100 athlete. Junior. She's still a junior. So, this player, we're talking at a 15-year-old girl, top 100, 3 years prior to her age group, playing three years out of her age group. And so through the profiling process, which is something I didn't mention earlier, I do this in business, I do this on tennis. We go through, we build a profile of the athlete. So it's going to be learning style. It's going to be likes, dislikes. It's going to be decision-making tendencies. It's going to be, you know, all of those sort of little key pointers that lead us into, all right, this type of player we need to develop into an all-court player or a net rush player or an aggressive baseliner or a, you know, counter-punching type of tennis player. All of those end-game decisions on game style, and we want stylistic differences, comes from the profiling process. So when I profiled this young athlete and she had this horrible technique, I realized, wow, what a fighter. Look at the character on her. How tough is she? Look at the intensity. And then I'd ask her about what sort of sessions would you be doing? Like, explain to me what was a usual session for you prior to, you know, us starting this relationship. There was no coaching. It was literally ba-boom, 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 ba-boom. And so here comes a girl who's got to the top 15 on her own, no, top 100, I should say, on her own, yearning for coaching. And so the other thing we realized is we'd start a session and all she wanted to hear was stories. It was all, so when you were with that player, how did they do this? And so when you were with, what sort of times were they running? When you were, you know, when you were traveling here, blah, 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 blah. What sort of food were they eating? What time were they eating? Very hard to lead in the industry without experience. It's really, you know, and then the question is, how do you get experience? And it comes back the other way. You need opportunities.
phenomenal. We're coming close to the end here, Conrad, and man, I've missed you talking about education and coach education, and you've given me an idea for a spin-off from this that I'm going to approach you about later, but just want to come back to a couple of personal things for you. Yeah, I call it the leadership layer cake, and your recipe for leadership includes things like experience. So get experience, make the most of your opportunities. Don't be a protectionist. Be willing to teach and learn. Be aware, understand the people around you. So have a due diligence mindset, an awareness mindset, empower people. I know it's a very rich, fruity leadership cake you've got there for us there. So the question is, with all that in mind, who do you see in the world today as an embodiment of those leadership attributes?
Well, that's an incredibly good question. You know, I have to say it. I mean, I hate to be, I hope I'm not cliche, but I look at someone like Rafael Nadal, and I want to look within my industry. I don't think anyone could understand without knowing tennis what the guy has just done. 13 French Open victories. That is like inconceivable. In my opinion, there is no greater feat in any other sport. Now, that for me, and you sit down with him and you talk to him. The guy is humble. The guy can talk to a 5-year-old. He can talk to a 50-year-old. He can talk to a peer. He just embodies everything from experience, like I just said. He values family. He values quiet time. He's not looking to be in the spotlight. He's developed an academy, you know, for young kids. He's got a charity. All of these things, for me, someone like Rafa Nadal, what a leader. And, you know, a leader on the court, off the court, in the sports development, in sports science. If you go to his academy, and I've been fortunate to be there, it's phenomenal. It's like what they got in there for recovery. They're valuing all the things that most people don't value. Recovery, rest, nutrition, the food, the restaurant is out of this world. And so I look at what Rafa Nadal has done. You know, he's created a museum. And I feel like that's a guy who really embodies everything that is a leader and a game changer. Roger Federer is the same. You know, outside of the sports industry, some guys who, Chris Scott, who I don't know if you know him, he's an AFL football coach. He's a coach, arguably the greatest coach of all time, about to go down as, he's a Geelong Cats head coach. We grew up together, went to the same school together. And, you know, just phenomenal. I followed his career as an athlete, coach, as a human. Scratch golfer, you know, phenomenal. So, yeah, there are some people out there, and Rafa Nadal's number one.
And that's really nice to hear that you've got people that you can think about in your industry and across the industry. I love asking that question. We talk about leadership, you and I, and then we've got to look out there and see who's walking the walk on it. So coming to a couple of things that I'm passionate about that's helped me with my own equilibrium as a person on my journey over the years, been books and music. I love reading and I love music, right? They help me with balance. So on your journey, what would be the one book or the one piece of music you'd take with you to maintain equilibrium?
Yeah, I'm going to start with the music because for me, music reflects my mood a lot.
Yeah.
I'm a guy who I really like calm. I really like calm. So I'll often wake up in the morning and I'll put on some type of yoga music, or I'll put on some type of Balinese type of meditation music. I get into that a lot. I like to listen to the Buddha Bar type of music, remixes. I find it calms me a lot. But then I have moments where I'm really, you know, feeling like listening to a little bit of Pearl Jam or a little bit of Live, Throwing Copper, or, you know, I'm a big fan of Counting Crows, Eagle Eye Cherry, some of that stuff for me. It's great. I'll fluctuate between those depending on how I'm sort of feeling. Regarding books, I mean, I know it's boring, but I love my sport. I'm about it. So I love reading The Inner Game of Tennis. I'm not sure if anyone's ever read that. It's a short read. It's a fascinating read.
What was it?
The Inner Game of Tennis by Tim Galway. Absolutely phenomenal book. Well worth the read. It'll change your life if you're interested in tennis. You'll understand a lot about what the guys are doing. But also, you know, the autobiography of Andre Agassi was a great read. I suggest everyone read that at some point.
Right.
He talks about the love-hate relationship of sport and, you know, the drive that was put in him by his father, who was coming from a, you know, an underprivileged background and whatnot. Yeah. But just the drive it put in him, it's very interesting stuff.
Fascinating. Okay, so the last question we have, which closes out the show, we've talked about leadership. We have our own recipe for solid, effective leadership. What's the one luxury you would keep with you on this journey that enables you to be the leader that you always want to be?
Yeah, I hope this answer is correct. I hope I can answer it this way, but I'm going to say, and I'm being challenged dramatically at this moment thanks to Corona, but it really is the ability to travel. That's a luxury that really defines both me and my wife and my family. She's from Mexico, I'm from Australia. We like to get to both those places. And I find that every time I get back home and anchor my roots, it just motivates me even more. Like I get out to do, it's like a reset for me the whole time. So the luxury is definitely travel, no doubt about it. It just keeps everything tasting fresh in life.
Yeah, good for you. I'm missing that as well. So here you, Conrad. Well, mate, look, it's been lovely having you here. And thank you for taking time out of your schedule to be on this show. And I wish you the very, very best. And when we can get on a plane, I want to be flying up to New Jersey to come and visit you at the Center Court Tennis Academy.
You're always welcome, Angus, and thank you for reaching out to me. It's been a privilege to spend time with you. And, mate, look, any time that I can be of any assistance, I'd love to. And if anyone wants to pop in, any of your listeners are ever in the area and they'd like to pop in, say good day at the Center Court Tennis Academy and Sports Academy, New Jersey. We're 25 miles out of Manhattan, so feel free to pop in. It's a great part of the world, and we'd love to see any of you, especially you, Angus.
You can give me some lessons and you can pick up my technique and my character.
I think we'll just get straight into training mode with you.
I love it. All right, Conrad. Appreciate it. Thanks, man.